Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's the House Arctic Policy, Economic Development, and Tourism meeting is going to get started. Today's date is April 20th, and it's 11:30 a.m. here at the Ramona Barnes Room here in the Capitol. With us today is Representative Josephson, Representative Newman, Representative Tallarico, and myself, Representative Westlake. Also with us is House Records Heather Evoy. Thank you, Heather. And running the keyboard for us over there is Carl Graham. Sorry, Kyle. Please make sure that your phones are on silent. We have just one piece of legislation for us in front of us today, and it's House Joint Resolution 9. It's Arctic Marine Safety Agreements, and it's sponsored by myself. We are working with version A today. So at this time, I'll invite my chief of staff, Jesse Logan, to come up and present on HJR 9. Brief at ease. Back on record. Jesse Logan, my chief of staff, please begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And committee, thank you for hearing the bill today, HJR 19, Arctic Marine Safety Agreements. My name for the record is Jesse Logan, Chief of Staff to Dean Westlake. I'm also a former policy advisor to the Arctic Policy Commission. I'm going to give you a bit of background on that in a few minutes. This resolution primarily deals with marine safety and prevention measures, and particularly as they pertain to international traffic in the Bering Straits and bilateral agreements with Russia. This slide here shows the definition in both the federal statutes and in Alaska statutes of what the Arctic is. That little yellow box you see there is the Bering, the constriction point of the Bering Straits, and this is a little graph that I got from the Marine Exchange showing the vessel traffic over the last few years. So specifically, this resolution outlines some of the needs and challenges in ensuring that all vessel transiting the Bering Strait adhere to the same safety and prevention measures. As the committee knows, beyond 3 miles, the strait is under federal jurisdiction, and beyond the end of the exclusive economic zone, it is international and Russian waters. So the main focus on this resolution is the vessel traffic here in the Bering Strait. So the resolution commends the formation of the Arctic Waterways Safety Commission, which you'll get some more information on a little bit later during this committee hearing. It also urges the governor and the state congressional delegation to promote the adoption of spill prevention measures and international agreements. And it urges the President of the United States and the U.S. State Department to initiate negotiations with the state's coastal neighbors and to enter into agreements to ensure safe and environmentally responsible marine Arctic operations. Without the uniform safety and prevention measures for all vessels transiting the Alaska waters, the states become increasingly vulnerable to adverse effects in the event of a mishap or a tragedy. After my presentation, we'll have Paul Foos and Captain Ed Page come up and give you an outline, some more specific details of how this resolution would fit into international agreements, and also a good presentation on the Alaska Marine Exchange, which I hope provides information for the committee. I wanted to give you guys a little brief background on how this ties into some of our state policy and to the Alaska Arctic Commission that existed for just over 2 years. And that commission's goal was to develop an Arctic policy for the state and to create an implementation plan for that policy. So for 2 years, the commission convened public meetings around the state. We started in Juneau. Then we had one in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Barrow, Kotzebue, Nome, and Alaska. Each one of these meetings, we started off with a full day of listening sessions from local leaders, community members, and stakeholders to basically gather information. We wanted this to be as an inclusive process as possible. In 2015, the commission delivered its final report and implementation plan, as well as an executive summary, which I think that provided for you there on your desks. I have more copies in my office, and it's also available on akarctic.com. I'm going to highlight a few pieces of the Arctic policy that's codified in statute now. The policy was a direct result of the Arctic Policy Commission's work, and 2 years ago, Representative Herron ran HB1, which codified Alaska's Arctic policy. And I cherry-picked a few pieces out of here to explain the relationship with this resolution and current statute. As you can see here, it's AS4499-105, and it's the Declaration of Alaska's Arctic Policy. And in A2A, it states that we need to strengthen and expand cross-border relationships and international cooperation, especially bilateral agreements with Russia and Canada. We have further declarations within that policy to enhance disaster emergency prevention, spill response prevention, and search and rescue capabilities in the region in order to provide a safe and secure, reliable maritime transportation in the Arctic. One of the big issues with maritime transportation in the Bering Straits is that the United States only has jurisdiction over a portion of that. If all vessels transiting are not adhering to the same regulations, it's possible that we would see the adverse effects of those things. So it creates danger. Continuing on, further on in 105B, the state has decided in policy to support the strategic recommendations of the implementation plan, which you also have there before you, and to address the infrastructure and response capacity in order to support the Arctic region. In the AAPC's implementation plan, we created four lines of effort. And I wanted to highlight a few things out of the second line of effort, which is response capacity. And if you look in your implementation plan, each one of those four lines of effort is broken down to a multiple recommendations that identifies the problem, the lead agencies, how you would go about implementing something or moving forward with something. It's sort of a toolbook for policymakers is what we decided to go with. Here's a starting point for something. If this was a thing that interested a policymaker, here's a starting point. Identify some key players and some issues with that and how to move forward. So line of effort number two is address response capacity, because response capacity requires strong partnerships and communications to prepare for incidents, to respond and develop best practices. Recommendation 2A, ensure the strengthened capacity within the administration to address Arctic maritime science and climate security issues. The lead agency we identified there was the governor's office, and this resolution specifically speaks to the governor working with other stakeholders and the U.S. Congressional delegation to support bilateral agreements on a marine safety standards within the Bering Strait and elsewhere. Recommendation 2C, is to expand development of appropriately integrated systems to monitor and communicate Arctic maritime information. The lead agencies we identified there was the Marine Exchange of Alaska and Alaska Ocean Observing System. In a few minutes, you guys will see a presentation from the Marine Exchange and see exactly what they do. And it's quite fascinating if you haven't seen it before. This map here just shows the major Arctic shipping routes, and you can see that three of them all converge on the Bering Strait. Recommendation 2H is to foster and strengthen international partnerships within Arctic nations, establishing bilateral partnerships and partner, in particular with Canada and Russia, and to address emerging opportunities and challenges in the Arctic. Lead agencies here would be the Office of International Trade, our congressional delegation, the U.S. State Department, and the President of the United States. This little image here shows the Northeast Passage, and one of the reasons that it's so vitally important, not only that it's open for increased vessel traffic, is because it cuts down tremendously by 10 days and by 10,000 kilometers the vessel transit route. So it's a savings measure for shipping to the Far East and is increasingly being utilized. And I just wanted to bring back this one last slide again to show you, to highlight the increased amount of vessel traffic. Even though there's some variations of it between 2008 and 2016, you can see that there is an increased rise over the time, if you look on an average. This puts Alaska in a particularly unique place. Vessels that are not calling on ports in Alaska or in the U.S. Are considered innocent passage and are not necessarily subject to U.S. safety and prevention measures, which Mr. Paul Foos and Captain Ed Page will get into in a few minutes. But I just wanted to highlight the increased traffic and I would like the committee to be aware that this is increasingly a concern for everybody here involved. So that concludes the presentation. I'm happy to take any questions on the specific resolution.
Before we do, I'd like to recognize that Representative Tuck came in during your presentation. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I looked at the presentation. You emailed it to us earlier today. And I actually have a DVD on the Northwest Passage that I just bought from Fred Myers for like $4, and I thought it was a cheap DVD. I'll watch it, but it's interesting to see that the map that you have on the Northwest Passage is actually one of the two routes that they were trying to figure out for for many, many years, and just the opportunities that we have up in the Arctic. They said that as much as 15 to 25% of the world's supply of oil and natural gas is actually in that region up there. So that was really interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for Jesse or for Mr. Logan? Seeing none, I would like to open the floor for public testimony if anyone wants to testify. Seeing no one on the floor, do I have anyone online that wants to testify? Okay. I've got a William Harrington. And Mr. Harrington, I'm going to ask you to state your full name and affiliation. I'm putting you on now, sir.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and committee members. My name is William Harrington. I live in Anchorage. My affiliation is I'm a former private employed citizen, not a public employee. William Harrington here to congratulate you on the intent and the timeliness of this action. Lines 9 to 12, page 2, are clear that Alaska's ability to control other nations' Arctic oil and gas ventures is non-existent. On April 19, 2017, on Channel 15, BBC Japan programmed a show that had a feature on Russian-Japanese collaboration to deliver Arctic gas to Japan via huge LNG tankers. A $200 million Japanese investment was mentioned. It was not possible to fully gauge the entire situation from this reputable news source. Suffice to say, LNG tankers will fly the Bering Strait, the Arctic, if the Russian-Japanese consortium has its way. My modeling shows 12 to 15 years out. Forget about our gas pipeline to the Tidewater. Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harrington, and we appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else online that wished to testify? Hearing none, public testimony is now closed. Questions from the representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thinking through this a little bit, and information is always a good thing for us to learn. Mr. Chair, when I was in my first year working on Arctic Policy Council in its first year, before we turn this seat over to the member from Barrow, we worked on, my office worked on the infrastructure policy and wildlife policy. And in the infrastructure policy, there was a lot of discussion on ports and where the entry port is going to be to the Arctic, whether it's going to be at Dutch Harbor. They have a lot of already infrastructure in place for dealing with large ships. And there's discussion of another port up in the northwestern area of the state. Could you give us an update of where we're at on that discussion and ports? And I think that'd be interesting information.
Sure. Thanks for the question. Through the chair, Representative Newman, this is a longstanding question on the infrastructure, particularly with a deep water port, which doesn't exist north of Dutch Harbor, which is 800 miles from the Arctic Circle. The most recently identified by the federal government and the Army Corps of Engineers was a dual port in Nome and Port Clarence. And we did have an update in this committee earlier in the session on what Nome is doing to bring that to fruition. There's also possibilities at Point Blossom near Kotzebue, and I'm sure that there are other folks farther north that would like to have a port. I also want to add that one of the final reviews of the Army Corps of Engineers on the Deepwater Port in Nome specifically stated that without an acre tenant, such as oil and gas drilling in the Chukchi or Beaufort Sea, that port may not be economically viable. However, with the right kinds of agreements with Russia for vessel transiting, there may be opportunities for calling on ports for vessels transiting through there. Additionally, ADAC has the capacity to be a storage and distribution center for vessels that have ice-capable navigation capabilities. to come down through the Northwest or the Northeast Passage, drop their cargo in ADAC and move back and stay within the icy waters where other vessels can then distribute to either the U.S. or to Asia.
Another question. Thank you, Ms. Chair. And do you know if the Coast Guard, where do they have ports in Alaska? I know they got one in Kodiak. Is there any other?
To the best of my knowledge, through the chair, Kodiak is the main port or the main station, and they do temporary stations that move between Arctic exercises north of Barrow, sometimes on the ice and sometimes out of Kotzebue. I believe that Captain Ed Page probably would have a better answer.
And maybe they could answer this too. Our congressional delegations have been working very hard to try and get a new icebreaker for America, hopefully stationed in Alaska. Maybe they could give us an update on where we're at in that discussion, where their facilities may be located. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Hearing none, what we are going to do is hold the House Joint Resolution number 9 in this committee now, and we are going to move on and speak with Paul, have him introduce himself on the record, and give his presentation. Thank you.
It's okay, Mr. Chairman. Captain Page should come at the same time. It'd be easier for us to do it that way.
Well, thank you.
For the record, Paul Foos. I'm the president of the Board of Directors of the Marine Exchange of Alaska.
And I'm Ed Page, the Executive Director for the Marine Exchange of Alaska. We have several slides here to hopefully clarify some of these issues and answer some of the questions. Just for way of reference, Mr. Chair, which I know I appreciate your coming down and seeing the Marine Exchange earlier, and for the benefit of the rest of the committee, the Marine Exchange is a nonprofit maritime organization here in Juneau that started some 16 years ago. Paul Foos and I go back some 30 years, back when I was in the Coast Guard and serving in the 80s, when we had a lot of marine casualties and oil spills and vessel groundings and fires, what have you. And he was the mayor of Dutch Harbor, but also a diver involved in some of these vessel incidents. And I served some 33 years in the Coast Guard. I've been in the Marine Safety Program almost 50 years now between the private industry and the Coast Guard. And during that period of time, I worked on the Exxon Valdez spill for several years. And I had several search and rescue cases with bad consequences, loss of 43 lives and whatever involved in those. So I became a big advocate of prevention. And so when I left the Coast Guard, Paul and I talked about this Marine Exchange concept and aiding and bringing the industry to develop solutions. So our board of directors is the marine industry that operates in Alaska. It's the ports, it's the tanker operators, fishing vessel operators, container operators, pilot association, towing industry. So these are some of the solutions a nonprofit has developed with support from the state of Alaska, some funding through the cruise ship head tax. The Coast Guard is a major contributor through the funding of this system. If we shut it down right now, this is the nerve center for the Coast Guard. It goes in our operations center, the tracking system. So I'll explain that a little bit more. And the Marine Exchanges are basically information brokers, exchange maritime information. So we're going to talk about how our focus has kind of shifted from the Aleutians at one point in other areas of Southeast, and there's a lot of emphasis now on the Arctic. And my belief, and my president shares this belief, that it's better to close the barn door before the horses get out. So even though it's not a huge amount of shipping, it is growing, it is increasing, there's increased risk, and we'd rather shut that down and not suffer a consequence of a major oil spill. So some of these slides hopefully will clarify some of these issues. I'll get back to the chair, Ms. Newman, about some of these other issues as far as the port development and the Coast Guard icebreaker situation. But bear in mind, I've been out for several years. I still have a lot of colleagues in the Coast Guard, so I meet with them all the time. So I'm not the best source, but I have some information on that. So moving along, obviously we're here to kind of give some background support and provide the context of this resolution that you've proposed here, Mr. Chairman. And as Jesse Logan had mentioned beforehand, there's increased shipping, and we like to see as a new maritime frontier. The Admiral District Commander, who I just met with a couple of days ago again, but even the Headquarters Commandant, who's visited with us, and the Vice Commandant and others, recognize that the way to deal with these new challenges of maritime safety and environmental protection is not the same way they did business in the past by putting lighthouses in and buoys in, what have you, that we need to use new technologies. And that's what the Marine Exchange is really doing, is an advocate of applying new technologies to aid maritime safety and environmental protection. And, of course, New Frontier, like these huge cruise ships, as we're all well aware of, that cross over the Northwest Passage this last summer, something we never had beforehand, and a lot of emphasis put on tracking that vessel and ensuring that if something did go wrong, it's minimal. The Arctic Waterway Safety Committee was something that the communities have developed. I was actually advocating for this because when I was captain of the port for Los Angeles Long Beach, most of the work they got done there was to bring the maritime community together, the cross-section of everyone's, all the stakeholders, and deliberate and collaborate and come up with ideas. And so this really allows for local input, and they really, the locals own Arctic Waterway Safety Committee. So we are, I serve as a technical advisor because I know how the systems work, and but the Coast Guard goes to all those meetings, and they're very closely paying attention to what the locals are interested in, what their concerns are, so they can manage that threat and protect their backyard, so to speak. And this is the Arctic Waterway Safety Committee region, and this relatively new organization set up a year, they're still you know, getting on their feet, but it's a great forum to ensure that the local residents play a role in the decision-making as far as how you manage shipping, how far offshore, what kind of risk mitigating measures are in place, what have you. And going back to marine exchanges, basically our maritime organizations, nonprofits, they go back to the actually 1800s and provide information to the maritime community and the Coast Guard, and they have a stable force because they're there for some time as the vice churning of Coast Guard people. And so we established marine exchange, and in the back, in the earlier days, they were using spy glasses and semaphore and chalkboards to pass that information to the local community. Obviously, we progressed to PDFs and PDAs and smartphones, what have you. So and computers. And a lot of what we're talking about today and what we can do now was not possible about 10 years ago. There's some new technology, automatic identification system, which is akin to transponders and aircraft that by an international maritime organization is required on all vessels, major vessels, and so that's the way we're getting information. Every couple seconds, that information is being broadcast, and so we built the receiving network to take advantage of that. So we're tracking cruise ships, container ships, Coast Guard vessels, ferries, fishing boats, tankers, you name it, in this nerve center in Juneau. In fact, at 24 hours a day, 7x24.
They put out a signal about every 6 seconds, latitude and longitude, and it's accurate to 3 meters. So we know within about 10 feet where these vessels are. We can tell which way they're pointed even.
And so and what we've built with support from the state and the Maritime Ministry and the Coast Guard is some 130 receiving sites throughout Alaska and the Arctic, of course, that are picking up this information. And these are the sites that we have up in, up in Alaska, in the Arctic, Alaska, and this is providing our maritime domain awareness. And our staff actually build and operate and maintain these stations. So this is some of the flying around Alaska and using boats to build this network of receiving stations. And that's the 24-hour operations center. It's the largest vessel compliance monitoring system in the world, 1.5 million square miles. The next closest is Australia, has one for the Great Barrier Reef, which is only 100,000 square miles. So as we all know, especially this committee knows that Alaska does everything big. Yes, sir.
Excuse me, I don't mean to. Representative Tuck has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Where is this monitoring center located?
Sir, through the chair, we're right on the waterfront, and everyone's invited to come anytime. Next to the bridge, in fact, the big construction is going on right now. We're about 100 yards from that big construction on the waterfront by the end of Harris Harbor. And that's our new building, actually, being built. But it's above Juneau Electronics. Maybe you probably know Juneau Electronics more than a marine exchange. So maybe you should say that, and I think that might ring a bell.
And, yes, sir. And if I may, Representative Tuck, I'd encourage everyone to go down there. It really is something, and that vessel that had sank, that vanished with all hands, they can give you a more in-depth perspective over there because they could see this stuff as it was happening. So it's a marvelous piece of technology. Thank you. Carry on.
Sure. Thank you. And I might add that this system has caught the eye and attention to Canada and Russia. In fact, I've flown to Moscow and Ottawa upon their invitation. In fact, they foot the bill because they're trying to replicate what we've done here very inexpensively. We've done it and very quickly, and they're trying to find how they can do that. So we're sharing this technology. We're also sharing a concept that we're all in the same boat, if you will, and that we have the waters, oil spill in one water can migrate to another water and what have you. So there's a lot of common interest and come up with a common solution. And this is just some of the waterways that we're managing, and we've outlined distances offshore and safe practices up in the Arctic, what have you. And one of our watch standards are here today, but 24 hours a day, our watch is monitoring compliance with these voluntary standards that the marine industry has agreed to participate in to minimize the risk of oil spills. Our focus is really aiding prevention, but also in aiding response. So if something does go wrong, we immediately know where the vessels are in the area to provide assistance so it's not a major disaster. But we also know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and we learned that hard way through Celadon IU, and a lot of what we developed was to prevent recurrence of Celadon IU. We didn't know it was too late. The Coast Guard contacted us. We hear there's a vessel in distress. Can you locate it and tell us where it is? At that point, it was an extremis. The Coast Guard couldn't help them. Tugs couldn't help them, and the ship broke in half. Coast Guard tried to rescue the crew. Helicopter crash. 6 crew members died from the ship, that is. Major oil spill, loss of vessel. The tools we put in place now would probably prevent that from happening because we had early notification. So now we have information. And we're also keeping vessels further offshore. So vessels no longer do – that'd be a hard picture to get right now unless they're coming to port because they're not allowed to do that anymore because of these new standards. That is if they're subject to U.S. regulation. That's where some of this resolution has to do with is urging the international community to get together so we're not just limited to having a safety net for vessels engaged in U.S. trade, but all vessels. And this is actually a snapshot I took this morning of ships in Alaska operating right today. So that's, as you were indicating, Representative Westlake, this is the kind of information that comes in here. Yes, sir?
Absolutely. And we've got a question from Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome. This is wonderful information, Captain. What size of vessels do you monitor? You're not getting all the way down to fishing vessels, or is there a specific types of vessels also?
Sir, that's an excellent question. Through the chair, actually, the Coast Guard expanded the carriage requirements. There's a couple different requirements. There's the international maritime community requirement, and then there's countries have other requirements. And so every commercial vessel over 65 feet is required to have this technology, including fishing vessels. So as it's turning out, that a lot of fishing vessels any size are putting this equipment on. It's relatively inexpensive, like $100 to install on a vessel. And now they can see other vessels approaching them. And so instead of them being out at night and see some lights on the horizon and their nets are out and worried who that is and who to call on the radio, they can see the name of the vessel, the size of the vessel, the destination. And they can call them on the radio by name and say, Crystal Serenity or what have you, you're approaching my nets, please keep away, take the following path, what have you. So more and more vessels, even recreational boats, are now getting this technology because it's really one of the biggest technological advances in maritime safety for the last 30 years or so.
So let me add, too, that for these vessels, there is an emergency button. You're sinking, you're going down, you got problems, and you need to notify somebody. You punch that button, our watch standards pick it up. It comes across as not a siren, but it's a buzz that comes across. It says, okay, this vessel's in trouble. And then we used to say search and rescue. Now there's no more search. They're just rescue. We know within 10 feet where they are. They go right to them. See some other vessel nearby. It's probably not a Coast Guard ship. They're pretty thin across the state. But, you know, we had the Juris sinking out in the Aleutians and 26 crew members on board. And who saved them was a 1,000-foot container ship on the Great Circle route. You see them sailing along over the top and then do a 60-degree straight down to go save those guys. So, I mean, there's a human life component to this as well.
And Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Captain, what is the average cost on to outfit a boat to have this technology on it?
Well, the average cost on the larger commercial vessels, they require to have a more sophisticated, what they call Class A AIS. So that's more in the neighborhood of about $2,500. But they allow smaller vessels to have what they call a Class B AIS, which is more in the neighborhood of about $500.
That sounds very reasonable. Yeah. And is there a yearly fee that goes with this to cover
the cost of service? No, sir. There's no communication fees or any additional operating fees to having that equipment.
The transmitter and you're gone.
Yes, sir. No, it's
thank you.
We were talking about before in the resolution is about innocent passage. You saw this picture before, how many vessels are operating right now in Alaska. But this is how many vessels that are what we call innocent passage. That means they've been engaged in trade with Canada or some other, most likely Canada in this particular case. But the way the laws are written, that the Coast Guard has jurisdiction out to 200 miles where vessels are engaged in U.S. trade. But if you're engaged with a foreign, so these vessels are most likely going from Vancouver, B.C., or Prince Rupert to China, and they really have no trade, but they're going through our waters and present a risk to our waters. And so the challenge for us is try to bring these people into the fold as far as complying with these risk mitigating measures. We can see them, but they're not necessarily required to stay offshore, which is one of the safety measures we have. Say, stay far and offshore, so when you break down, you have time to do something about it. Time to find a tug, time to send a helicopter out with parts, or time for the engineer to fix the problem. But if you're 1 mile offshore, we have no time to fix the problem. And so vessels agree to that, and that's a standard of care. And as many of these things still, many of these vessels still comply because we urge them, even though they're on instant passage and not subject to U.S. jurisdiction, that's a good standard of care. In fact, I've had a German shipping company once, captain come, which is much bigger than me. I was a little intimidating figure, but they came to my office and pounded my desk, and why do you require my vessels to do an innocent passage? I said, I'm not requiring. I said, but tell me, do you think it's a good idea to stay offshore and to notify us when it's a casualty and have your AIS on? He says, of course. I said, so why wouldn't you? He says, I make all my vessels do it. So it was an easy sell. He just didn't like anybody suggesting how to run his fleet of vessels, if you will.
And the other thing is the insurance carriers are really locking on to this now because they're the ones that are going to pay the bill. They have an incident, natural resources damage assessment for an oil spill. The cargo on board some of these ships are, what did you say?
$1 billion in some cases.
Yeah. I mean, a container ship. $1 billion worth of cargo on one ship, you know, containers. So.
If you take some of these container ships now are 950 feet long. If you take the containers off that ship and put them on the dock, they will extend 40 miles end for end. So you think of how many containers that is. It's just phenomenal. It's 10,000 containers.
20,000 now, the latest one that came up.
Right, 20,000 TEU ships are what they're coming up with. Yeah, right. And this is just some of the graphics of North Slope activity and more activity up on Kaktovik. But this really is kind of showing you how we do historical track lines so we can identify the risk and higher risk events. Most of these are research vessels or tugboats, whatever, so they don't present the same risk. But in some cases, they're tankers. In that particular case, that's an oil tanker. So we pay much closer attention to an oil tanker. Or is that one? That one isn't, I'm sorry. There was another one that was a tanker. But we watch closely to oil tankers or larger cargo vessels. But we watch all of them, obviously. And this is one of the graphics, again, of the Bering Strait, color-coded, showing the types of ships and where they go. And you can see that, you know, the green is basically cargo ships. You see a lot of them going on the Russian side, staying close to their side. And on our side, a lot of tugs and barges with cargo ships going to Red Dog Mine to haul out materials. So this is the type of assessment this information provide. And this is used by the Coast Guard to determine port access routes and what have to manage the risk. So we're working hand in glove with the Coast Guard. You've seen this graphic a couple times beforehand against the growth, again, the growth of traffic going through the Bering Strait region. We've also working closely with the Coast Guard in what they call a Arctic Next Generation Navigational Safety Information System, whether icebreakers and what have you, to develop these transmitters that can transmit. And unfortunately, that site's not coming through, but transmit information on whales and whalers and other information that can be used to manage the risk and respond to incidents. Similarly, this is an example of a buoy in Cook Inlet, which wouldn't stand in place, obviously, with all the ice moving about, but it's a virtual buoy that we're transmitting with this new technology. So,
and this is displayed to the bridge of the ship where you can't hold a buoy in the ice. They see it just like a buoy. They know if they're, you know, right side green, you know, left side red, you know, they know exactly that they're in the channel. That channel going into the port of Anchorage is only 1,000 feet wide through the Cook Inlet shoal, and you have to hit it. And they've got to go through on high tide, and that's the vessel is that long. So that's all the wider that channel is. So it's really important in the winter to have these virtual buoys.
And then the International Maritime Communication, I'm sure many are familiar with as far as the polar code, is this one in effect this year, in January this year, and it's implemented a series of measures to, again, manage risk in the Arctic, recognize an oil spill in the Arctic, very damaging, very difficult to recover, and that historically, majority of oil is not recovered, so the best option is prevention. And they recognize the IMO, this is some excerpts of International Maritime Organization treaties, whatever, is they're placing a premium on ship monitoring and tracking. They mention the protection of Arctic people and Arctic coastal communities and their traditional lifestyles. So, again, recognition, that's important. the protection of the unique environment ecosystems in the polar region. So everything we're talking about is showing the state engagement, represent the state's engagement, interest in ensuring that the Arctic is protected, and we implement measures now. This is an example, unfortunately, didn't show up too well, of a ship that's not complying with procedures and how we notify them. This is another vessel didn't comply with the risk mitigating measures, and our 24-hour operations center contacts the vessel, advises them or basically notifies them that they're not complying with the standards and asking what their intentions are and not directing, and the vessel immediately will change course and comply and send back a message saying message well received, noted. We've deviated to comply with the standards.
He was trying to go through the wrong pass, and that pass doesn't have the water depth to accommodate that vessel. So our guys caught it and said, you need to reorder and come back through the designated pass.
So we're making sure they go through charted waters that well surveyed and sufficient depth. So we designate those.
Representative Tutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions. First of all, so they don't need marine pilots to come into Alaska waters that close? Or is that just for passenger vessels?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, I can answer that. It's only if they call on a port, a state port, that they're required to have a marine pilot. If they're just sailing through, there is no marine pilot is required.
Wow. And then the second question, one of your slides with the if you might just jump back to keep going right there. So on the IMO, why is the jurisdiction, why isn't it consistent all the way around the, it looks like it's like probably the 70th parallel or something?
It's a good question, and it's in most simple terms because of Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream obviously influences the Arctic waters such that they're not that Arctic in that region of Norway and that area, which my daughter lives there, by the way, but so it is pretty moderate when you go there. But the so they don't want all these additional measures for waters that aren't really ice-covered waters or act like Arctic waters. So they basically said, we're a different water. We may be within the Arctic Circle, but we're really different because the Gulf Stream so much influences the temperature of the water and makes it much milder. So when you go up to Tromso, like we have, above the Arctic Circle, it was a very pleasant above the Arctic Circle experience, if you will, compared to being on our area. So it really has to do with the Gulf Stream.
And if I may, Mr. Chair. But that's not the Arctic Circle, right? That's
No, sir. That's, yeah, yeah. That's, I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. And similarly, to the chair again, I mean, we obviously bring below the Arctic Circle for Alaska because we see there's similarities to the Arctic region, the same needs. So we've kind of moved that line around as far as the polar code. It's not strictly the Arctic Circle. It's Arctic waters what it is. And then fit in that definition versus strict 66 degrees north.
Thank you,
sir. And to them, you know, we talked briefly about the Arctic Waterway Safety Committee. We've been working with them closely as far as identifying ways we can minimize potential for local mariners being impacted by larger ships and for larger ships to see them. So we have this Arctic Maritime Safety Net project where we will be able to track the smaller vessels, hunters, if you will, and they can see other vessels. And we also develop an app that can be on their iPhones, whatever, so they can click on the app and they can see Arctic maritime activity. They can see ships in their region. Unfortunately, this shows Juneau right now because there's no ships up there, so I had to use the most what is available right now. But it's an easy way for the locals to actually see and have that maritime domain awareness so that if they know they're going out in their small boat, there's some vessel coming by that might be breaking ice that could change the whole environment in which they're going to be operating or hunting. That could be presenting substantial more risk, obviously. And I'll defer to...
So I want to speak to this. So what we've got is we've got National Oil Spill Pollution OPA 90 standards that people are supposed to meet that says you have to be able to respond to an oil spill within a certain amount of time with a certain amount of equipment. Now, if Alaska had to meet those requirements, this is what it would look like. We would have this many depots set up around the state at a cost of hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, which would have to be borne by the entire industry. So this is why the Coast Guard said, look, we realize you can't meet the standards. We'll allow you guys to propose prevention measures. So that's where that came from. You know, our group came up with these measures that said this is how we can keep it safer. So that is the jurisdiction. And, you know, Mr. Harrington was partly correct when he spoke about that we don't have absolute jurisdiction over it, but when you propose this as an alternative, they can accept it. So that's what's happened. And so that's why we have these prevention measures in place. Now, it doesn't include about 35% of the vessels, which are Canadian. It certainly doesn't include the Russians. And so this is why we're working on international agreements with them. They have some of the same concerns. Our vessels are going right by the coast of British Columbia. Very close. Now, when they're in our waters, yeah, they stand off. Once they get to Canadian waters, they're right next to the shore. And we had a couple incidents there. So we're working with Canada. You know, we're also working with Russia. I've been there a couple times the last couple months, and they seem to be open to it. Despite all of, you know, everything else that's going on with Russia, they see this as something that may be even more important, that we can at least show we can work together somewhere in an area that nobody can criticize. So now, this is the Arctic Economic Council, and what did we get here?
This slide didn't show the...
Okay. Well, what's happened is that, so the Arctic Economic Council are the main native corporations that are in the Arctic. They're the Arctic shipping companies, and they've come together. Their point is they'd like to see standard requirements. They like our prevention measures, and what the mariners want is standard requirements. They don't want to have one set here, go a mile later, now I get a completely different set of requirements. So they want to standardize it. They want to make it reasonable. The insurance companies want to do it, too. So there's a business component of it. And for our shippers that are American, they look at this way of leveling the playing field. They have to meet these requirements. Why shouldn't everybody else and everybody be safe? So that's why we have to go with these agreements. Now, this here shows the circulation patterns in the ocean, in the Arctic Ocean, and the point is if something happens in the Bering Strait, it's gonna affect the whole coast, and these are the circulation patterns. So that's one of the concerns that we have. When you look at the resolution, there is a reference in here to the Law of the Sea Treaty, and the United States has not passed it, and according to our congressional delegation, we're probably even further away than we were. The countries that have passed it have the authority to put regulations in place in ice-laden waters. So that includes Canada and Russia. So they can set those regulations on their side. We can apply our technology to it. That's what we've offered to them. We see the entire Bering Strait, everything that goes all the way through Russia, Canada's reach, and we have all of them. So we're able to offer that. I guess I would just go one more slide here. So this is what we proposed to them, a Bering Strait Seaway. It's kind of modeled along the St. Lawrence Seaway that we have along the Great Lakes with Canada, where we agree where the shipping lanes are going to be. We monitor, we do our prevention measures, vessels of opportunity, all of those things. So this is what we're proposing to Russia now. And when I went to this last conference, Vladimir Putin spoke, and he specifically references, he said, we want to work on the Bering Strait together. So that's helping us kind of get through the Russian bureaucracy. I'm going to be meeting with the Minister of Transport here pretty soon. We think we got a chance of pulling this off. But what allows it is this technology that we've already developed, and it's just not that expensive. So Our budget is about $4 million a year of that. A little more than half of it is the private sector. $1.7 million is the Coast Guard per year. They get all the data, so they know where everything that's going on. State of Alaska, $600,000 a year, and that comes from cruise ship head tax funds, which really are very restricted in what they can be used for. You'll see that number in your capital budget again this year, and we've been able to utilize those funds. In terms of the ports, that question that you raised, Representative Newman, you get further north of Nome, Kotzebue, it looks like you could put in maybe 28 foot, and it depends upon what you call deep water draft. Mm-hmm. So when you look at 35, 40 feet, which is what the Navy wanted, and when, we talked to Senator Murkowski, asked the Secretary of the Navy to come in, and they said, oh, we want to, project our sovereignty military into the Arctic. She says, that's great. What resources, what money are you bringing to the table? Oh, we didn't mean that. She said, what did you mean? She said, well, let us assure you we have very strong feelings about our sovereignty in the Arctic. So that's kind of where that stands. So that's why they came to the conclusion they need a major industrial partner like a Shell or somebody to come in to really drive the drive the economics of it. In the meantime, everything that's being done up there is being done by barge, and it's really extensive, and it's very effective. It is expensive. You know that representative living up there, but, I mean, you get the goods that you need, and they're able to operate. But a lot of the ports up there are just the beach. That's it. You drive onto the beach. Everywhere else, I'd be considered a wreck, you know. So I think that's our presentation. This resolution would be really important. When we talked, the Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization was here in Juneau for the Arctic meetings. We took him down there. He was really impressed by it. But he says, you know, we really listen to official government bodies. And so this resolution would be something. We've asked for the governor to write a letter. He's working on that. And this would be something that you could also take to a group like PENWAR, Pacific Northwest Economic Region. Mm-hmm. They've been fully briefed on this. They really like this because it includes Canada and all of that. So I do think that this would be one that wouldn't just sit on the shelf. It would be used effectively. It's not just putting more requirements on business. You know, as Ed said, it was the industry who set this up. And we've never had, it'd be just like the air traffic controller. The pilot never complains when the traffic controller says, you know what, you're too close to that other airplane, or you're landing on the wrong runway. Mm-hmm. Right? But that's kind of essentially what we do. We've never had any complaints, you know, of this is some overbearing government regulation or something like that. You're out there in the middle of nowhere, and appreciate that somebody somewhere at least has their eyes on you.
I do. Well, any more questions for either Captain Page or Mr. Foos? I do have a couple comments. I want to thank you, and I like the idea of congruity with, especially radio congruity with the Russian side. And I want to thank our friends that, like the Shells that went out there and did those studies, hired those ships to do the wildlife studies and ran up and down that coast. I mean, we wouldn't have had things. And as you were talking about this, I thought about being accurate within 10 meters and being a first-line response if there's a spill or something on the other side of the border. Exactly. Coming through, we could have time to be able to categorize. I mean, one of the big problems we have is the flow charts out there and what goes on. So I really do want to thank you both for this. And if there's anything else we can do, we certainly are interested. It's a tremendous job you're doing.
Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate your support and the whole legislative support over the last several years. This really would not have existed had the state not stepped up the plate several years ago and allowed us to use Exxon Valdez settlement money to help get this jump started. It was the industry and the state that jumped up, and the Coast Guard said, we want in. It basically came down to it. And follow through to a question earlier from Representative Newman there, to the chair. I mean, the Coast Guard is very much paying a great deal of attention. I'm sure you've noticed the Commandant's been here several times, and they're engaged as best they can. Obviously, they have Congress and funding issues, and that's why they didn't build their own system. That's why it's being done by a nonprofit. And that has happened in other locations, actually in L.A. when I was down there. But the icebreaker, you know, all indication are it's going to come to fruition, but it's a very long process. It's a mega bucks project, a billion-dollar project. We're not going to see it for 10 years. So some of the things the Coast Guard is going to put in place don't move that quickly. But the good thing, at least right now, there seems to be a fair amount of support behind the icebreaker and having some sovereignty and control and influence on the Arctic. So, but with respect to ports, the Coast Guard has no ports up in the Arctic, obviously. The closest still remains Kodiak. They've put air stations, temporary air stations up in Barrow and Kotzebue, what have you. But they may go further along those lines, but that's basically when they deploy up, they have an air station, but otherwise their ships still move maybe from Kodiak, but they could be from other areas too. They could be from Hawaii for that matter.
Okay, gentlemen. Thank you very much for your presentation. And we do have a person on the line that came on, and Rachel Callender out of Cordova. You wanted to give a presentation, please put yourself on the record and tell us what you'd like to talk about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rachel Callender in Cordova. I appreciate you guys putting me through to testify today. I'm calling on behalf of myself and also the Arctic Encounter Symposium.
Yes,
Mr. Chair. Okay. I wanted to call in and
Rachel, could you hold? There's a question from Representative Tuck for you.
And actually, questions to you, Mr. Chairman. Do you want to reopen public testimony if she's going to be speaking on the resolution? I don't know. I don't know if she's speaking on the presentation of the resolution. But
okay.
If she is, you may want to reopen.
Let me reopen that then.
That way, it's on the record.
Oh, okay. It's okay. We're putting you on the record here. Rachel, go ahead and speak, please.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just wanted to call to support this effort to raise awareness. I am the founder and executive director of the Arctic Encounter Symposium, which is the largest annual Arctic policy and economic symposium in the U.S. We just hosted the fourth annual Arctic Encounter last week in Seattle on April 13th and 14th. This was the fourth Arctic Encounter in Seattle. We also hosted a group of young Alaskans, actually, makes up our team. We hosted last year an Arctic Encounter in Paris during the UN Convention on Climate Change, which was also referred to as COP21. And I guess I just wanted to share that we had really stimulating discussions last week, and I think it's really timely that your committee is bringing this up this week. In addition to many, many Alaskans participating at the conference last week, we heard in person from Senator Lisa Murkowski, Congressman Don Young, the ambassador of Iceland, the ambassador of Norway, former prime minister of Greenland. The list goes on and on. And all of these people, I just wanted to share with the committee today, were enthusiastic and optimistic last week to work with the state of Alaska, with the legislature, with our congressional delegation to push forward and push the envelope on many of the issues that are impacting the Arctic and the people who live there. So I wanted to call and lend my support for HJR 19, the work that you're doing to raise awareness, and I guess just share that, you know, our mission, a group of young Alaskans, we started this organization, which is now a nonprofit in Alaska. Our goal is to gather together all stakeholders in order to engage challenges and debate solutions for responsible development, sustainable environments, and healthy communities. So that's sort of the mission there. But I just wanted to share with the committee that I think that we really have an opportunity. If I learned anything at our fourth annual symposium last week, is that we have an opportunity and a responsibility to raise awareness together. And I guess I just feel compelled to point out that we're in a time and place in history in which we really have to innovate and advocate for the best future possible results. And there are many young Alaskans around our state who are engaged in these issues. And I just think everything that this committee can do to get Alaskans involved in this topic, since it's going to impact the future of our state in such a massive way, I commend you for that. And we stand by ready and willing to help.
Are there any questions for Rachel? Hearing none, Rachel, we do appreciate it. Public testimony is now closed. And thank you again for the call. We do appreciate hearing from folks like you. So this concludes the scheduled business for today. I thank everyone for being here. Time now is 12:29, by golly, and thank you all.